On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, a push and pushback on Iraq, a new plan and new skepticism.
So America will change our strategy to help the Iraqis carry out their campaign to put down sectarian violence and bring security to the people of Baghdad. This will require increasing American force levels. So I've committed more than 20,000 additional American troops to Iraq.
Madam Secretary, your intelligence and mine is a lot different, and I know my time is up here. But to sit there and say that, Madam Secretary, that's just not true.
Well, Senator,
that is not true.
Senator, if you allow me to finish, I think there is a point I'd like to make about the Iraqis killing Iraqis.
American warplanes screeched overhead here, and helicopter gunships were seen firing into the streets below. Explosions rang out across the city from the Haifa Street neighborhood.
You pass the minimum wage, and you dramatically change life for millions of people.
We will fix California's broken healthcare system and create a model that can be used by the rest of the nation.
President Bush tells the nation he's sending an additional 20,000-plus troops to Iraq. Nebraska Republican Senator Chuck Hagel lets Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice know he's not buying in. In Baghdad, the killings go on, fierce fighting on Haifa Street just outside the heavily fortified Green Zone. Back home, the House votes to boost the minimum wage to $7.25 over time. And California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger unveils a bold new health care plan. This hour on Point, our news roundtable goes inside these headlines and more. We have a terrific panel with us this week. From Washington, Andrea Mitchell, chief foreign affairs correspondent for NBC, is with us. She leaves today for the Middle East with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. But she's with us first. Her memoir, Talking Back to Presidents, Dictators, and Assorted Scoundrels, is just out in paperback. Welcome back, Andrea. Great to have you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And from Washington, Doyle McManus, Washington Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Doyle, great to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you. Here we go.
Hello, Tom, Doyle, and Andrea.
So, first of all, we've got the president and Iraq, and it's back, and it's back. Let's listen to just a bit from his big speech Wednesday night.
It's important for our troops to hear, and it's important for the American people to know this is new. This is something different that enables the military folks to predict that we will succeed.
My mistake there. That's actually Fort Benning yesterday. The president continuing to try and push his plan in the face of all kinds of pushback on Capitol Hill yesterday. Andrea Mitchell, step way back with us here. We waited a long time. It was a long, slow drum roll for this presidential speech. Here we are a day and a half after. What's happened? Where is the country on Iraq? It's confusing right now.
Well, the country is as against this war as it ever has been. The president's popularity and support for the war at all-time record lows. And what Condoleezza Rice faced in Congress, in the Senate and in the House, was a firestorm, not only because so many of the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee are presidential wannabes, but also because there is such resistance to this policy. You've got Hillary Clinton now leaving very importantly for a trip with Evan Bayh, who has declared that he's not running for president this weekend to Baghdad. Bob Gates on the Hill again before the Armed Services Committee. All of it coming together with Republicans, most importantly, as well as Democrats, arguing vociferously against the war policy and challenging Condoleezza Rice that it doesn't make sense, it doesn't add up. Chuck Hagel, as you just heard, saying it's a lie, it's not going to make any difference. And Barack Obama saying, where will it end? Voinovich, Bill Nelson from Florida saying, you've lost me, who had previously supported the war. They had no expectation that it was going to be this fierce.
Just how bad it was going to be. Let's listen to a little bit of that. Here's Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice trying to sell the president's plan yesterday before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
The president took a good deal of time with a lot of input from a lot of people to come up with a considered strategy that gives us the best opportunity for success.
Pushback, lots of it. Here's Senator Russ Feingold, Democrat, Wisconsin, same committee hearing, saying that the Congress should shut off money and end America's involvement in Iraq.
Congress must use its main power, the power of the purse,
to put an end to our involvement in this disastrous war. And I'm not talking here only about the surge or escalation. It is time to use the power of the purse to bring our troops out of Iraq.
And Republicans, here's Chuck Hagel again, Republican Senator, Nebraska, telling the committee that the president's approach is a huge mistake.
This speech given last night by this president represents the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam, if it's carried out.
Doyle McManus, what do you make of this near firestorm of pushback from Capitol Hill? Andrea Mitchell says they had no idea at the White House that the buzzsaw would be this sharp, this loud.
Well, Andrea is right. And in addition to the criticism that you're hearing, there's also the sound of silence. Where are the loyal Republicans who should be rushing to the president's side? The answer is there are very, very few. John McCain of Arizona is one of the very few who stepped up and actually said that he thought this was a good plan and a good thing to do. Now, the problem, of course, being that a lot of these Republicans are running for re-election. George W. Bush isn't. The second problem is that even the administration has remarkably limited confidence that this plan is going to work. You have an administration here 3+ years into Iraq that was left with a list of very bad alternatives. They chose this as the least bad alternative. It is, in a sense, the one last shot at turning things around. But even administration officials who briefed those members of Congress before they unveiled the plan said they don't know if this is going to work. There are a lot of uncertainties out here. There are no promises. Well, on that base of very low optimism, it would be very risky for any member of Congress, even from the president's party, to go out to the public and say, this is a great plan and I'm sure it's going to work.
Jack Beatty, sound and fury and silence here, but does it matter? The president's the commander-in-chief. The orders have been given. Troops are already going in or preparing to go in, new ones with the 82nd Airborne. You know, do we have a president on his own hook here? Never mind the sound and silence.
I think we do. I think we have a desperate president. Howard Feynman of Newsweek said, quote, Bush spoke with all the confidence of a perp in a police lineup. With his knitted brow and stricken features, he looked, well, scared. That's an indication, I think, of the lack of confidence even he has in his plan. What troubles me is that this really tactical, minor tactical adjustment, I mean, that's what it is. It's an escalation, but it's not an overwhelming escalation, that this is going to preoccupy Congress when I think the president indicated the real danger and perhaps the real the future course of events when he spoke of really confronting Iran and Syria. And, there needs to, Congress has got to address that before it happens. Because once it happens, and the
once
momentum,
what happens, Jack?
Once we, the chances of this administration provoking an incident and a war with Iran, I think now are very high. Seymour Hersh was talking about this, quoting people within the administration from the Pentagon, that Bush might actually think of a kind of mega disaster, a way of sort of trumping all the catastrophe with an even larger one, to sort of raise the ante here. And Congress has got to figure out a way to prevent that before it happens, perhaps by coming out with a changing the authorization to use force, perhaps by threatening impeachment if the president goes ahead with provoking a war. And, of course, there's a great role here for the people, really. I mean, the people can't stand on the sidelines and have this, if that is, in fact, the direction he's going.
The president was not explicit on that front, though, even while he was talking practically. We had the U.S. raid on the Iranian consulate in Erbil. We heard about the Kurds pushing back unhappy on that. But let's listen once again to the core formula that he put forward as the rationale for why this is all so important.
Failure in Iraq would be a disaster for the United States. The consequences of failure are clear. Radical Islamic extremists would grow in strength and gain new recruits. They would be in a better position to topple moderate governments, create chaos in the region, and use oil revenues to fund their ambitions. Iran would be emboldened in its pursuit of nuclear weapons. Our enemies would have a safe haven from which to plan and launch attacks on the American people. On September the 11th, 2001, we saw what a refuge for extremists on the other side of the world could bring to the streets of our own cities. for the safety of our people, America must succeed in Iraq.
Andrea Mitchell, there remains the core formulation that the president offers the American people. What do you say to it with 3+ years of experience in this war?
Well, clearly what Secretary Rice and others defending the administration's posture are saying is that this government, this Maliki government, has to be given more time to make it work, that they're going to pressure them, they're going to demand that this government stand up. But what they're saying privately is that they're not sure that Maliki is up to the task, and that while they want to give him a little breathing room, he may not be able to survive this, and he may not be able to deliver. He was noticeably silent, not showing up for an expected news conference yesterday, so you don't even have the Iraqi government endorsing a policy that they had initially opposed during Maliki's last meeting with President Bush in late November in Jordan. He had argued for a smaller footprint, for the U.S. to withdraw from Baghdad, let the Iraqis do it. And that was one of the options that was seriously considered and rejected by the White House, because they realized that there was no way that they could go after al-Qaeda in Iraq, which they do want to continue to do, and not deal with the sectarian violence when it's right there on their doorsteps.
Here's an exchange between Senator Joseph Biden and Condoleezza Rice. She says she's confident that Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki knows the clock is ticking.
I think he knows that his government is, in a sense, on borrowed time. Not just in terms of the American people, but in terms of the Iraqi people.
Are you confident?
I'm confident.
She's confident. What about John McCain? Senator McCain at Senate hearings at Capitol Hill this morning says we cannot have catastrophic failure here. Let's step on the accelerator.
We should make no mistake. Potentially catastrophic consequences of failure demand that we do all we can to prevail in Iraq. A substantial and sustained increase in U.S. forces in Baghdad and Anbar province is necessary to bring down the toxic levels of violence there.
Doyle McManus, substantial and sustained, and the kind of same core formula, or at least a big piece of it, that the president used, we cannot have a catastrophic failure in Iraq. Does that end up protecting the president's plan, despite all the sound and fury here? Does he get to go ahead? Because is that still armor for him, the argument that McCain and the president make there?
Well, it's not armor. It's fraying considerably. You can watch public agreement with that proposition erode in the polls over time. Look, I think the president gets to carry out his plan over the short run. The question, of course, comes up, what will Congress do about it? The first thing Congress will do is pass some non-binding resolutions expressing disapproval, but we knew that already. Mm. There is the beginning of an anti-war caucus in both the House and Senate that will introduce measures to try and cut off funding. But Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, has said he would filibuster that. It's impossible to imagine such a measure getting through both houses at this point. But the real test of this policy, and even the administration is looking at this, is what does Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki do, and what do his allies do in the next 3 months? They have said that the Iraqis need to bring more troops into the fight in Baghdad. They actually have to show up and fight, which is something that they haven't always done in previous months. They have to be willing to go into Sadr City, the big Shiite neighborhood where many of Prime Minister Maliki's supporters live. They have to be more even-handed about the way they prosecute the war. Well, if you listen to all of that, there is the hint in what the administration is saying that this is, that not only is the clock ticking, but this is the Maliki government's last chance, and if the Maliki government doesn't perform in a relatively short period of time, then the administration may be looking for a plan B. There may be a jumping off point.
Plan B, Andrea Mitchell, could that be an even wider escalation? Jack Beatty says, watch Iran, watch Syria. President Bush may be tempted to ratchet things up, not down. You've written about the sort of weak support from American allies in the region. Is that a real option for the U.S.?
They are really thinking seriously about the threat from Iran. And what you saw with this attack on an alleged Iranian consular office in Erbil in Iraq, which has infuriated Kurdish leaders, who are the most pro-American among all of the Iraqis, is a real step up. They have moved another carrier group in the Persian Gulf. They've already pre-positioned a Patriot missile emplacements in Qatar and Bahrain. They are seriously stepping up military activity as well as diplomatic and intelligence activity against Iran. There were a series of interesting exchanges and troubling exchanges, as Jack has pointed out, at the hearing yesterday when Joe Biden said to Secretary Rice, tell us now, and I'm telling you now, that any crossing of the border into Iran without prior congressional notice and approval would create a constitutional confrontation with this Congress. And she did not rule it out. She did not deny that they are considering any kind of military action. Now, look, for weeks and months, in fact, I've been discounting any of these reports. But in talking to intelligence officials and administration officials in recent days, they have now decided that the spring diplomatic offensive with Iran has failed, that they are shutting it down, and that Iran and its ascendance, because of the U.S. policy in Iraq partly, and partly because of U.S. support, implicit support for Israel in Lebanon when Hezbollah was perceived to be the victor over the summer, has now led to a resurgent Iran, and that is part of her mission as she now flies toward the Middle East, is to try to reassure Arab leaders, Sunni Arab leaders in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan, that Iran is not going to be the ascendant power dominating the region.
How does she assure them of that? You're headed to the region today with Condoleezza Rice. As you say, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and then the UK and Germany. That's a big lineup. What are her talking points? What's she pushing on this trip?
It's supposed to be a big launch of Middle East diplomacy to show that she's serious about the Israeli-Palestinian connection, and she may have a few surprises up her sleeves in terms of prisoner exchanges. But as Yogi Berra would say, this is deja vu all over again. As I was writing the paperback over the summer, I was on the plane with her, shuttling between Jerusalem and Beirut, and it was really that failed diplomacy that has produced this Iranian intransigence, and the Iranians are also, of course, fueled by windfall oil profits. The intelligence briefing that the Senate Intelligence Committee was given yesterday is that Iran and Hezbollah is now the real power in the region. So the only thing she can tell them is that she is going to dig down and really focus on the Palestinian problem, which is what both kings Abdullah in Jordan and Saudi Arabia have been demanding for years now, and take that seriously and also try to push back against Iran.
There's, of course, yesterday, John Negroponte, outgoing director of national intelligence, saying Iraq is at a violent and precarious juncture, al-Qaeda significantly expanding its global reach, and Iran's power in the region growing fast. Andrea Doyle McManus, Jack, we've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Let me begin to turn to them. Lou is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Lou, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I mean, I'm livid. This president, this dictator, gives a speech Wednesday night and Thursday afternoon, 4 o'clock our time, 12 o'clock midnight Ramadi time. Our Marine son gives us a call telling us that a second deployment, telling us that his stay where that was supposed to get done in April is now extended to June. His speech is Wednesday, and my son calls us. This was planned months in advance. All this grandstanding going on by all our congressional leaders, it's nothing but farce.
Lou, what does your son say in Ramadi? He's going to be staying on longer. What does your son have to say about it, Lou? What's his attitude?
Well, he's in a combat zone. Of course he's just...
What can he think?
He's got a job to do. But, there's also risk with the job. And that's the anxiety that we as mom and dad have to deal with.
And it's real, and we've seen it in families right across the country in the day and a half since the speech. Lou, good luck to your son in Ramadi. Jack Beatty, there's the voice of one of the families carrying the load.
Yes, and isn't that just the grotesque part of all this, that just a tiny portion of our people are bearing this burden, and now it's intensified. If, in fact, they use these troops, this increase, to confront the Mahdi army in Sadr City, 60,000 strong, the VA hospitals, the psychiatric wards, the tombs will have plenty of... the casualties will be fearful. You know, for every person killed in Iraq, thanks to miracles of medicine, 16 are wounded. But think of that. And the wounds are very serious. They are major head trauma. They are limbs. They are eyes, and they are psychiatric wounds. Mm-hmm. And all of this is what's now in prospect for the people at the head of this. And it's a terrible. You know, in Vietnam, they spoke of the war was a poor man's fight. And the class aspect of this, that the people who, you know, you read about it in the biographies of these soldiers who, you know, well, they wanted to get a little more money for college, so they joined.
And they went.
Their way of getting up in the world, and my gosh, to think that they're facing this fearful gauntlet, it's just awful.
The president himself, in a bit of tears yesterday, giving the Medal of Honor to the family of the Marine who fell on the grenade to save his fellow troopers, Marines, but of course he's pushing ahead here. Let's go to Mark in Hanover, Massachusetts. Mark, what do you think?
Well, it's really kind of difficult to say what I have to say, what I'd like to say after the soldier's father calls. But I'm a fairly liberal Democrat, and this horrendous mess as a result of this ideological, you know, foolishness of Bush and the neocons is just awful. But I don't see, there's obviously no good way out of it. You know, it seems to me that there are actually some good aspects of what Bush said, which is, you know, I don't think he went far enough in terms of that the only mission that we should do at this point now is to embed and train with the Iraqis. I think that the U.S. presence, soldiers' presence should be minimized. And the only presence should be to train the Iraqi military, to train them to be a more professional army.
But we heard on this show yesterday from retired Colonel Caleb Sepp that if you put in 20,000 more U.S. troops, you can't withdraw those American officers to train Iraqis. They've got to manage American troops who are there. They are going to be on the street. But you're saying it's got to happen anyway, Mark. You're sympathetic to that.
No, well, what I'm saying is I'm saying that I don't think we should have American military troops at all patrolling visibly. I'm saying pull the American troops that are the American visibility patrols, which are ineffective and are just provocative, back. Just embed U.S. military with the Iraqis, train them to be professional, somehow train them to respect, you know, that they're, you know, working for the country of Iraq, not for Sunni or Shia or tribal, you know.
Right. Easy to do, but easy to say, but hard to do. We have found, Andrea Mitchell, can they turn the corner here? And aren't we, in fact, more likely to see not just training, but American troops on the street in the fight directly here? Not just visibility, but we're told actually living in the tough neighborhoods, not retreating to bases when the fighting night is done.
Exactly. They will be in the front line in every real sense. They'll be in door-to-door operations inside the worst neighborhoods of Baghdad. And one of the little-known things that also happened was that Bob Gates, the new defense secretary, announced a change in the call-up of National Guard, removing the 24-month limit on active duty service within any five-year period. And without that limit, from now on, National Guard reservists can be called up for active duty repeatedly for repeated tours, which has not been the case, and taking them from their civilian lives over and over again. And that will have a major effect on, of course, making more troops available, but also putting more Americans at risk in this operation. It's hard to imagine what the escape strategy is. I don't know if your listeners or your colleagues or our colleagues here today can even think about it, because they're talking about benchmarks. But one of the real disappointments, according to Jim Baker and Lee Hamilton, in a statement issued by the co-leaders of the Iraq Study Group, a statement issued late last night, was that there are no real penalties for the Maliki government if they don't reach these benchmarks.
So please, please, please. Anthony's calling from Washington, D.C. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It's something that military people have known since the age of Rome, that if you lose strategic credibility, you may be bailed out by tactical excellence. But if you lose tactical excellence, you're never going to win with a bad strategy. We've lost both strategic credibility and our tactical excellence is being depleted every day by overextending our military force. Our strategic credibility is undermined by the fact that we've created a Shia crescent. So strategically, Saudi Arabia can't step in behind us very much because we've empowered Iran. We've empowered Hezbollah. We've created an umbrella of Shiism.
Are you military, Anthony?
I served in Saudi Arabia and in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And my Arabic is probably as good as Condoleezza Rice's. And I can tell you, most Muslims in the Middle East understand we're blowing it strategically.
So what would you do now? What would you do? We're looking for an answer here.
What would I do? First thing I would do is I would pull back out of Baghdad and go to almost not a siege mentality, but I would put my troops on in desert bases, and I would stock them heavily. I would make sure that they're able to actually confront any large scale involvement by the Mehdi army or any other to back up the Iraqi troops.
And let Baghdad burn. Let the kind of ethnic cleansing run its course there.
No, you don't let ethnic cleansing run its course. What you have to do is we didn't let ethnic cleansing run its course in Bosnia when we finally got in there. But we knew how to defend ourselves. We don't want to be like the blue hats from the UN who become dangerous tourists running around. We actually want to be able to defend ourselves and protect our military, and also to give the confidence to the Iraqi military that we are there, that we will strengthen, that we will stand by them. But we can't stand by them by draining our tactical excellence. They have to understand that. So,
Anthony, we've got it, and we appreciate your call. I just got a bit before the break here. Dawn McManus, that doesn't sound like what the president's ordering at the moment. Do you still feel flexibility in these orders, these plans? Could it change in a month, in 2 months, if the plan as understood today doesn't get traction?
Well, what Anthony is proposing is something very close to what General Abizaid, the central commander, proposed.
And he's out.
And the president rejected it. Well, he's not out yet, but he's almost out. What that may turn into is a version of Plan B. That option will still be available if the Iraqi government and the Iraqi army do not show up and play the roles that the administration has assigned to them.
We're looking at a week in the news, push and pushback on Iraq, anger in New Orleans, Schwarzenegger on health care, and more. Andrea Mitchell, chief foreign affairs correspondent for NBC News, is with us. Doyle McManus, Washington bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Jack Beatty is here. Where does this country stand on Iraq now? Is Arnold the new savior on health care and the environment? And what about Jimmy Carter, the resignations at the Carter Center? Did Jimmy Carter go too far with Israel and apartheid? Carl's calling from Franklin, Connecticut. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I think Arnold is the perfect candidate to, having come from a country that has a successful health care plan, to champion health care not only in California, but maybe to set example and take it as a national health care plan somewhere down the road.
Does it surprise you to see the Terminator, Mr. Tough Guy, turned now and leading the way on environment, on health, and so on?
Honestly, no. And the only reason I say that is the fact that I lived and worked in Europe, and they have a different mentality when it comes to protecting nature, and maybe it's because they ruined a good portion of it a long time ago and learned from their mistakes and have made changes to move forward on it. And I think, you know, as all of us get older, we kind of change our views and our philosophies, and we kind of reevaluate where we're at and what we hold dear to our hearts and, you know, with children and so forth. I think he's looking to the future.
Carl, let us look at that. Doyle, I want to ask you about it. Let's hear California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger rolling out his ambitious agenda Tuesday in his State of the State address in California. He called for universal health care and global warming initiatives.
I have proposed that California be the first in the world to develop a low-carbon fuel standard that leads us away from fossil fuel.
And, of course, California's big. Where they go, a lot can follow. Doyle McManus, what do you make of the new Arnold?
Well, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger can't run for president. Mm-hmm. The Constitution forbids him because he was born in Austria. So he is determined to make his mark in history as governor of California. And you're quite right to point to both of those initiatives. The health care initiative is modeled in a sense on Governor Mitt Romney's in Massachusetts, but it's much, much larger. In Massachusetts, they're trying to cover fewer than 1 million people who are uninsured. In California, you've got more than than 6 million, including a lot of illegal aliens, so it runs right into a hot-button issue. On greenhouse gases and on carbon emissions and refineries, Schwarzenegger has said he wants California, as you heard, to set a world standard. What he's really doing is trying to invent, if you like, a new model of republicanism. There used to be the old Northeastern Republicans who were fiscal conservatives but social liberals. Arnold Schwarzenegger is kind of a Hollywood Republican version of that. The question is, can that turn into any kind of model for the National Republican Party? And I have to say I'm kind of a skeptic on that, because California isn't a lot like the rest of the country.
So when Capitol Hill, I mean, you're with the Los Angeles Times, but working in Washington, when Washington looks at Schwarzenegger now in California, do they see a challenge, a model, an irrelevancy because he's not going to be president?
Just as is the case in Sacramento, oddly enough, when Democrats look at Arnold Schwarzenegger, they say, hey, these are good ideas. We'd like to pick up on some of those. I think you're going to hear Democratic presidential candidates picking up these ideas before National Republican presidential candidates do.
Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Chip. Hi, Chip. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hey, what do you see, Chip?
Well, my personal opinion is that Carter didn't actually go far enough. The first use of the word apartheid relative to the situation in the Arab-Israeli conflict was actually by Desmond Tutu, who gave a speech in Boston where he said, I know apartheid, and what I saw in the West Bank was apartheid.
But he stirred up a giant hornet's nest here. He's got 14 of the 200 or so Atlantans on a kind of advisory board at the Carter Center now walking off the job. People saying, this is way too much, this word apartheid in your book title, Jimmy.
Well, actually, again, I'll refer you to Desmond Tutu, who I think can be reasonably expected to know a bit about apartheid. He's the first one to use that term relative to that situation, and he was right. And the only thing that's lacking is that no one in America has the courage to stand up to the illegitimate behavior of our ally, Israel. And that, in fact, is the problem. The fact that they're now building new settlements, even though they promised the United States for 20 years they would build no more, obviously means that they don't take their side of our partnership very seriously.
A problem for Israel and the Palestinians, or a problem for the region, Chip?
For both, because as many people have stated, one of the driving forces of hatred in the region is the ongoing Arab-Israeli conflict and Israel's intransigence in dealing with the issue.
Chip, let us pick it up. Andrea Mitchell, Condoleezza Rice headed to Jerusalem and Ramallah, in addition to all the other capitals we were talking about there. You hear Chip's complaint. You see the furor over Jimmy Carter. Is this framing things way out of whack, or is there something that American policymakers need to look at here?
Well, Condoleezza Rice is trying to relaunch Middle East diplomacy at a time when the Palestinians are in complete conflict and virtual civil war, and the Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, is at record-breaking low favorability. So the question that some people are asking is, with whom can she negotiate? And if she wants to broker something, who is going to be the deal-maker on either side? Time magazine, Walter Isaacson, has a suggestion that rings true because I've spoken to people inside the State Department about this, that she sees a new partner with the foreign minister, Livni, of Israel. But she, the foreign minister, who is also a woman and has been very closely negotiating with Condoleezza Rice behind the scenes, is seen as a threat by the prime minister. So there's a split in the Israeli government. There's a split in the Palestinian Authority, with the U.S. refusing to work with the elected Hamas leaders. And it's a very, very unlikely scenario. What Rice would say is that this is a new opportunity, that Iran's ascendancy has the counterintuitive plus for the United States of uniting the Sunni Arab leaders, the moderate Arabs, and for the first time, the moderate Arab states are willing to deal with Israel and willing to make some concessions because they are so afraid that without some kind of stabilizing, negotiating success in the Middle East, Iran will become so dominant. It's a strange argument, but one that she's been making and one she'll be making on this trip. About Carter, by the way, Dennis Ross has the former negotiator, Middle East negotiator for a dozen years under both former President Bush and President Clinton, has also come out against President Carter's book, not only because of the provocative title, which President Carter said was deliberately provocative, but because of alleged errors of fact and even some complaints of plagiarizing and misstating the maps and misstating the Clinton administration's Middle East negotiating strategy. So there are a lot of critics right now lined up against the book, but Jimmy Carter says he was trying to be provocative and did so deliberately.
And Andrea, what about the news we're reading here that the Bush administration is preparing to pour $80 or $90 million into strengthening the security forces of the president, the Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas, as opposed to Hamas? Is this the U.S. getting involved in another kind of civil war within the Palestinian community?
Yes, the U.S. has proposed this. The administration has been arguing with the Hill and is trying to get this legislation through to give Abbas the $86 million so that he can build up his military forces to push back against the Hamas forces. And it is precisely that, to try to prop him up, because they have so many fears that he will not be able to maintain any kind of leadership and that the Hamas forces will be dominant.
Let's go to Ibrahim in Boston. Hi, Ibrahim. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for accepting my call.
Yeah.
Actually, I am from Somalia, and actually I spoke with my mother. And, you know, the past 6 months prior the recent, you know, invasion of Ethiopian troops in Somalia, southern Somalia mainly, she told me, you know, the peace, the progress, the opening of the ports, the restoration of the security in the city of Mogadishu, the cleaning of the city, the helping of the poor, the driving out of the warlords, has actually something that the Somalis had not seen for the past 16 years.
So is she happy for what's happened in the last month?
She's happy. Not only her, the vast majority of the Somali people, both in the diaspora and in Somalia, were actually welcoming the Islamic courts, the progress that they have made for the Somali people. And now the United States government is supporting the same the warlords who dragged the American soldier in on the streets of Mogadishu, who are actually terrorizing the Somali people, and who caused the, you know, a lot of displacement of the Somali people. And now the Ethiopians are also part of that. And what my mother told me last week is that the Ethiopian troops who are invading Somalia, they are targeting not only the remnants of the Islamic court, but they are actually targeting anybody who speaks against their invasion. And there has been a lot of demonstrations that they neutralized.
Ibrahim, let us pick that up. Andrew Mitchell, I think this is back in your court. I think I saw headlines this morning saying that after the American bombings and sort of rocket attack, the top al-Qaeda figures were not killed in that after all. Ethiopian troops have gone in and booted the Islamic courts out of Mogadishu. What do you make of the upsurge in military activity and American involvement in Somalia, Andrea?
Well, the intelligence officials who were briefing Congress only yesterday have acknowledged to me and to others that they were shocked, surprised by how quickly the Islamic courts collapsed. They thought that they had more support because people in Somalia were so desperate for any kind of stability. So they were surprised at the success of the Ethiopian army, and now clearly did not have a handle on what the fate of the al-Qaeda leaders' alleged al-Qaeda presence there. Well, although al-Qaeda has been very active in Somalia, according to many, many reports. So I think what this tells us is that our military is further engaged and much more active there. That was a defense operation, not a CIA covert operation. But that our intelligence is really, really thin.
Don McManus, another hat in the ring for the presidency this week, 08, Christopher Dodd, senator in Connecticut. How do you see this enormous swirl of foreign policy issues factoring in to the beginnings of that race? Is that where resolution is going to come? Is this country going to have to digest this through a presidential campaign?
Well, in fact, you've seen the presidential candidates on the Democratic side line up very strongly against the escalation of the war. Senator Hillary Clinton, who had been on the fence, in fact, had said before the president's decision, had said, well, she would basically wait and see. And she was taking a lot of heat from liberal and progressive forces in the Democratic Party for not coming out preemptively against it. She very strongly came out against it. So I don't think you're going to see much of a debate among those candidates. The question may come up, gee, why is Senator Christopher Dodd jumping in when that's already a crowded field? Senator Clinton, former Senator John Edwards, Senator Barack Obama. There are some very, very strong names, some of them already raising money, Senator Joe Biden. That's always an interesting thing to watch in Washington, and I sometimes think that politicians like the rest of us have their own biological clocks. And Senator Dodd missed a couple of chances earlier in his career to run for president. He doesn't want to miss another one. He may turn out to be running for some other job, like vice president or secretary of state.
Mm-hmm. Jack, what do you make of the political chemistry turning here? We've got more people coming into the race there. There's Arnold sitting on the side with a lot of initiatives, but not up for the top spot. How do you see the politics boiling here, Jack?
Well, I think Arnold has introduced the major domestic issue for the campaign. It'll be whether there will be universal health care coverage in America or not. I hope that the Democrats don't go down his road, which is a very complicated, cumbrous system that he's instituted to avoid a single-payer system, which had been proposed and passed by the California legislature last year. However, that's going to be the main issue domestically for the Democrats, and we'll have a real ideological battle about that with the Republicans. I think the foreign policy issue really is cutting against the Republicans here. John McCain is the hawk of hawks, and the position he is holding now is not one shared by 75% to 80% of the American people. Unfortunately, or fortunately for him, it's shared by Republicans. So he's going to have a real problem if he wins this nomination on fighting until forever, it seems, in Iraq and perhaps even in Iran. Then, on the one hand, in the Republican primaries, and then turning to the general electorate and saying, "Well, what?" I think it's a real cul-de-sac for him, and I think really the only hope for him with the general electorate was that he would that there would be a secession, that there'd be a down, you know, that would be withdrawing from Iraq. But the deeper we go, it seems to me, the worse it looks for him in a general election.
Doyle McManus, how do you read the Republican presidential politics here? Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, big phone-a-thon, raising $6 million+ earlier this week, putting him out front on the money side. John McCain is taking out the, you know, let's stay big. You heard him, substantial and sustained in Iraq, he's saying. Can he make that case, win a primary, then turn the corner and have a chance in the general electorate?
Well, Jack is right. It gives McCain a certain advantage in the primaries. He's being a loyalist now, not a maverick as he used to be. Mm. And if you look at the Republican electorate, the Republican base still supports the war. It does create a problem in the general. To me, the most interesting move by any Republican presidential hopeful all week was Senator Sam Brownback, the Republican from Kansas, mm-hmm. who wants to run as a social conservative. He came out and said he doesn't want this escalation of the war. He's not for it. So all of a sudden, the Republicans now have an anti-war candidate in the race.
Andrea Mitchell, we've got half a minute left. You're headed off with Condoleezza Rice to the region. We see this complex politics behind her at home. How does the region read that as her plane sets down in every capital? Are they closely watching the politics behind her? Where does it leave her when she tries and makes the executive case?
It leaves her weakened, significantly weakened. And of course they're watching. They're watching in every capital. And when they see her on the defensive, being attacked by Republicans as well as Democrats, they see an administration that is in its second term, that is lame duck by any definition, and that now is defending a policy that has been rejected by such large majorities of the American people, as well as majorities in both houses, in the House and Senate, with symbolic votes about to happen next week, more likely, in the Senate. This does not give her as much leverage as she had hoped for.
A tough job for Condoleezza Rice heading out to the Middle East and beyond. Andrea Mitchell will be with her. We thank you for being with us before you go, Andrea. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Andrea Mitchell, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for NBC. Her paperback version of her memoir, Talking Back, is out right now. Doyle McManus, thanks for being with us today from the LA Times. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.